Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 24th, 1999. We are in the Creekside Room of Koinonia this morning. Your presenter is Christy Traina. Today's session number is 99-7 and is entitled Animal Rights, Species, and Biodiversity. Let's listen in.
I'm Christy Traina. I teach at Northwestern University, and one of the areas that I teach in and write in, although it's not my only area, is an environmental ethics and theology. Yesterday, we had a long and substantive session on the Bible and creation and where we might find small seeds of helpful thoughts that would help us to develop an ecological theology. Today I want to have a much more discussion-oriented kind of session. And what I'd like to do is to begin with an exercise. And I don't know where this will go. We will see, because it really depends on who's here. What I'd like you all to do is to take a sheet of paper and something to write with and make three columns. For writing that. One, animals that you've cared for. And for anyone who, especially anyone who has lived on a farm or is employed by a zoo or whatever else, you may find that you need to list them by species rather than individual animals. Okay? Animals you've cared for. Animals you've eaten, and animals you've killed.
Does that count?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
All the ants or killing them?
Try to be comprehensive.
The animals meaning everything in the animal kingdom.
Right. Anything in the animal kingdom. And for people later listening to this tape, this is going to be a boring part because everybody's writing, so try it yourself.
Thank you.
category for you.
Oh, what's that?
Animals we host. Animals we provide habitat for on our bodies.
Ah, under our fingernails,
around our hair. Sticks.
Oh, I remember one. I've forgotten now.
There was a really good article in the New York Times about a year ago, which I've saved. I can certainly send it to you. But it listed all the animals that live on it.
Have you seen that one on TV where they show you it's really gross?
I think that's fascinating. That makes us all more part of the community of life.
Right. Things in your eyelashes that are crawling around.
That's right, yeah. In our scalp and in our
skin.
Intestines.
And their animals.
In our bloodstream.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Are bacteria part of the animal kingdom?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are
viruses?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
It's good.
Good questions. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think if it's... I think the vegetable has to produce chlorophyll. It has to... receive energy from the sun.
But viruses aren't.
Viruses, I don't know. They receive energy.
Isn't that the debate? What viruses are?
Right.
They're kind of crossover.
Yeah, but they're not. Well, they're not. They're sort of on the borderline between living and non-living.
Viruses are.
I think so.
How interesting.
They depend on the energy of the cells that they infect.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. Right. Are mushrooms not actually plants?
They're fungi. They're in a different. It's a different kingdom.
So mushrooms don't even go on the list.
And then there's actually a whole new life form. They're not even sure it's a life form. It's called prions. They're the proteins that cause mad cow disease, and there's a human equivalent of it. It's a long name.
And then there are cyborgs.
Cyborgs.
Right.
So what are cyborgs?
Cyborgs are on the liminal space between animals and machines.
Oh.
Hmm. There's a good argument, actually, that supports that we're all already cyborgs in the Western world. Mm-hmm. Due to the amount of technology that we use and the way that we use it. Mm-hmm. Are we cyborg when we drive a car? Not just when something's implanted in us, mm-hmm. but that we use it for to sustain ourselves and for our livelihood and as a part of our culture.
Right. Computers and email could be extensions of ourselves. Also, we could get back to the question of tools, right? This wasn't where I was going to go, but we could. Looks like people are mostly done with their lists. Okay, now see how many connections you can draw across from either two or three categories. In other words, if there's something that's in your cared for and killed column, okay, you can draw it across, or if it's in all three.
If you can
the dog with your car, well, maybe we'll exonerate you. By and large, the line drawing is not taking as long as the listing I'm gathering. Anybody want to share where their lines were?
I have fish. I've got an aquarium. I eat fish. And I have very occasionally
shellfish, fishing.
Okay.
Our grandma used to raise guinea pigs, and we ate them in Peru.
Okay.
Not willingly.
Not the same ones that you raised, though, right?
No.
And when you killed fish, they weren't fish that you raised. They were different fish.
Right.
Okay. So, and that's the only connection I've got going all the way across mine, and they were not the same fish either. Any other connections people have made? Maybe not all the way across, maybe just in two categories.
Fish. Rabbit.
Rabbits?
When I was in high school, they had a hunting day. And the boys would go out and bring back rabbits and fix it for the cafeteria.
Okay.
You want chickens. When I lived in Honduras, we raised chickens.
Did you butcher them yourselves?
No. Well, others did with whom I worked, but I didn't myself.
Okay.
I didn't get quite that great, I guess.
Okay. Anything else?
Sheep, pigs, and chickens.
Sheep, pigs, and chickens, and you raised?
I've cared for and eaten, but not even the ones I've cared for.
Okay. All right. Anybody else?
We cared for a crayfish, and when my son was in about second grade, all the kids in his class got little crayfish and a little shellfish to care for, feed them and everything, and then at some point you got to take them home, and so he brought that home, and we cared for it, and I have eaten something along that line, you know. So.
Okay. With the exception of fish, has anybody ever killed and eaten an animal? The only one I can think of is yeast besides fish. That almost doesn't count. Seems as though it wouldn't count, right? Because you can't see it.
Well, yeast is a fungus.
Oh, it is a fungus?
Yeah,
oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was. See, you've rescued me. All right, I'll cross that one off. So, we don't tend to kill our food. And how many of you have killed an animal you've raised?
Killed
an animal you've raised. You have.
But in mercy, killing.
Okay.
I have to make the decision.
Okay. So what sort of animal was it?
Cats, birds, one deer.
Okay. So that when they become ill or injured, it's a matter of speeding their deaths. And you weren't killing them for food.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Go ahead.
We had a lamb once. A pet lamb, but and my parents had it killed for food.
Your parents did this many more times than we did because they were country people.
Right.
So it was the Depression.
Right.
And, I've never eaten lamb since.
Mm-hmm. Our experience as late 20th century, cusp of the 21st century Americans, is that by and large, we don't raise what we kill and we don't kill what we eat. Okay? I thought that we're actually would be a few more people who had a few more lines to connect when I was teaching about animals and ethics to my students in college. A couple of them came from farms and told us about how every year there would be a pig, and you would give the pig a name, and you would scratch it behind the ears, and you would feed it table scraps, and in the fall, you butchered it. Okay? And so this was something even very familiar to a few of them. But it is not a widespread experience. If we've only got, 4% of us on the farm nowadays, and those are about the only ones of us who are doing this, we don't have a connection to the animals that we are eating of any kind. We don't have to lay hands on them, and we don't have to get attached to them as sentient, friendly beings, right, that we have affection for and then do them in, as our parents or grandparents did, in most cases, have to do at some point. Okay.
Can I ask what the significance of that is?
Yes, you can.
I guess that's a question you should ask yourself, I guess, ultimately. I mean, it's a question that a lot of people talk about, what does that mean, but what it means is whatever it means to the individual.
It does permit us to do one thing. How many of you have pets? Okay. Many of us have pets. How many of you who don't have pets now used to at some point? Okay. We're almost unanimous now. All right. Why do you have pets?
Companionship. The kids wanted them.
Right.
Connection to the animal world.
Uh-huh. Connection to the animal world. It's a way of feeling that you have that you're continuous rather than completely separate from them.
Pets love unconditionally.
Mm-hmm. Especially the furry ones.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Dogs. Okay. How many of us eat meat? At least occasionally, if not all the time. Okay. For those of us who eat meat, where do we get it?
Wrapped in plastic at the grocery store.
Right. Any other possibilities? Anybody else get it from anywhere else?
Sometimes we see it living in the tanks of the restaurants where we eat. I mean, I did list down lobster. Even though I didn't kill it, I knew that. I don't know when the last time was I ordered lobster, to be honest, but I'm just assuming that at some point, maybe 20 years ago, I may have ordered lobster that was killed live in the restaurant.
Right.
So.
And you said, I'd like that one, please. And he picked it out of the tank and
I
dropped it.
I did that, but there are very few instances when there's a direct connection between what I choose to eat and the death of some animal.
Okay.
I think it's even more disconnected. I think it's so disconnected that we don't associate meat with animals. Just like even the generation below us and us kids that are supposed to garden don't associate food with growing in the earth, really. I think it's a true dissociation from the cycle of life that our food is, our meat is packaged, so we don't see it as animal.
How many of you who have had either a small friend, a relative, or a child of your own say to you at the age of about 3 or 4, "Oh, look, there are carrots in the ground," or something like that. Or our kids get to the age of about 6 or 7 and they finally say, chicken, you know, they make the connection finally. Okay, so what if we call pet animals? We have called them companions. Unconditional.
Lovers.
Wow. Okay, and we have also called them connections to creation, I guess. Is that a good way to put it? I mean, what else are furry and feathered animals?
They feel good.
Okay.
Tactily.
Sensual?
Yes.
Okay. What else are they? Any other ideas what pet animals are, raised animals are to us?
There's something for kids that even goes beyond some of it, and I don't know what it is. Sometimes they're just ways of satisfying kids' desires.
Songs for kids. Mm-hmm. You have to talk to a person.
And also for kids, they are someone to care for.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes they make you sneeze.
Allergens, yeah. Many of us have that experience.
Playmates.
Independence.
Okay. Playmates.
Someone to wrestle and roll around when your parents
okay.
are too tired to.
For friends of ours who are blind, they have been eyes
and ears.
section.
And arms and legs.
Right. And here's another one. Until one of them takes your lunch outside, they're cute. I'm thinking of the ground squirrels and all of the calendars with kitties on them, right? Okay, they're cute. All right.
They provide us with aesthetic enjoyment. Like, for example, I can't think of any other reason why, offhand, why people hang out bird feeders outside their windows, but I assume it's because they like to see the birds.
And when you go into a pet store and you see a really gorgeous parrot, yes.
I'm probably going to get a lot of flack from this one, but they're also our slaves.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to anthropomorphize our pets, and one believe that if they had the same consciousness that we have, that they would choose to be in the situations that we put them in, you know. And who's to say, given the option of having a nice, safe home with people who love them according to their standards and not canine standards or cat standards, if that means something to them, that they would choose that safe environment, cared for environment, rather to be in the wild, rather, particularly animals that we domesticize that don't seem to be naturally domesticized animals.
Like ferrets?
Yeah. You know, would they, what, you know, are they given that choice? You know, they don't have the same choice-making capacity that we do as human beings, you know.
Our family's getting to about the stage where we're ready for a dog, right? I mean, finally, you know, the one who's almost five may soon be able to handle. My criterion is everybody could take the dog out. That's when we could have a dog. And recently I started to think, well, so what would make a dog want to leave dogdom and live in a house isolated from all dogs with people? And that's sort of getting at the question that you're asking, I think, a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Of course, I don't think all dogs. I think it's cruel to have just one dog. I think if anyone owns a dog, they should own, or a cat, either, they should own two.
We have two cats. They hate each other.
An ethical
yes.
And I'm not 100% against having pets. I just think that whenever that we take an animal upon and into our home as our possession, that we need to ask ourselves, to what extent is this lifestyle that I'm asking this animal to lead going to thwart its natural God-given tendencies that it was put on the earth to devour?
Yeah, and that's a good question to ask of the animal as a subject, right? About the animal as a subject. Okay, what do we call our food?
Beef.
Okay.
Oh, you mean instead of saying this is a how we are eating our
restaurants?
Right.
Protein.
Pork. Mm-hmm.
Bacon.
Hey,
ham.
Yeah.
And then we say seafood.
Notice how, I mean, chicken and turkey are a little bit different,
yeah.
But they don't have fur. Okay,
poultry.
Are you notice what's happening here?
It's like,
you never met a veal, did you? Did you ever meet a veal? Or a poultry? Did you ever meet a pork? I never met a pork. Okay, see what happens? It all becomes meat, and we don't have to call it what it is as a living animal. Okay? It does. I just heard something. Who said objectifying?
I did.
Yes. See, it enables us to objectify the animal that we are eating. Now, I am not suggesting that we all have to become vegetarian. What I am suggesting is that our method of speaking about animals is pretty arbitrary, depending on what kind of purpose we have in mind. Yes.
There's another thing about that list, and that is they're all animals we tend not to have as pets. I mean, there's yet another category which could have been meat, animals we choose not to eat. we choose not to eat dog, we choose not to eat cat, we choose in our culture. Now,
right.
Our cultures are different.
Right.
We choose not, but all their cultures have different attitudes towards cats and dogs, too. So our culture has affection towards dogs and cats, and there's another one that I was thinking of.
Horses.
Yeah. And rabbits.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think most people would object to seeing rabbit stew on a restaurant menu, but they would object to seeing meat stew, dog stew, or cat stew, I think. But anyway, so these are all animals we do not really have a cultural objection to eating because we don't have them as pets.
Right, and the ones we do eat, we let somebody else raise and slaughter for us, mostly, right? So we don't really have to pay attention to the fact that that an animal is going through what it's going through and eat it. Does anybody get the comic strip The Boondocks in their local paper? Okay, I wish I'd saved it. It went out with the recycling, but the gist of this particular strip was this. Two little kids out on the sidewalk after a rain. One of them is picking up the earthworms and putting them back in the grass like that. The other one says, "What are you doing?" "Oh, I'm putting the earthworms back in the grass because if we leave them on the sidewalk, they'll either get stepped on and squished or they'll dry out." And the second one says, "Oh, that's really benevolent of you." And then the first one picks up something and goes, "Bleh! What did you just do? It was a slug. I thought you were a lover of God, you know, of the creatures, that you were protecting and saving them." "I know, but earthworms are cute and slugs are ugly." Okay. What is it that allows us to see some animals as objects and other animals as creatures, as sentient beings, as companions to ourselves? This is not a practical question only, although it is a practical question. It's a theological question. Because when we start asking about animal rights, what we're really asking about as Christians is, what is the status of non-human animals with respect to God? Okay. And that is the tricky question. This will be the rest of this time will be a continuing to ask the question rather than a coming up with answers to it necessarily. What comes to your mind when we ask who is an animal with respect to God?
Everything alive.
Everything alive without
clarifying.
Right.
What has a soul? Who's a soul? And I have an uncle once who's a Baptist minister said to me that animals don't have souls, so therefore it doesn't, what we do to them in our dominion over them is not important as compared to what we do to other human beings, which relativity I can go along with, but the fact that we could do whatever we please with them because we don't believe that they have a soul, I can go along with it.
And why not?
Because God created them just as God created us, and they have a purpose on earth. God didn't create anything that has no purpose whatsoever. And if it has a purpose, then it's deserving. Love and systematic torture and murder of species of animals doesn't fit in my idea of love.
You know, the issue of what has a soul is a strange one too, because it is our human decisions about what has a soul are very cultural.
Yeah.
It's only 500 years ago that it was clear to many, many people that the people on this continent had no souls. And the black slaves had no souls. So it really strikes me as kind of a construct, what we decide is a soul or not.
Right. I've heard it compared to the comparing our mentality about our approach to animals that we, especially the ones that we view as food, to the mentality of the Nazis versus the Jews and everybody else that they persecuted, enslaved, and tortured, and murdered. That mindset is the same thing. You know, you're able to objectify, put them on a lower level, say that you know, this class of people is important, this species isn't as important as us. Then you start becoming capable of doing all kinds of things to that species. We're brother human beings, brother and sister human beings.
And in many cultures, not only animals, but non-living objects, like rock, a particular rock formation or plant, can have a spirit or a soul, right? Okay.
There's a really wonderful book, I can't remember the author, but it was published by Beacon Press, called Do Animals Have Souls? And talking about the behavior of various species, their play life, the way they love and nurture their young, things that indicate that the way they mourn their death. Certain species actually seem to have rituals for when one of the clan dies, they don't just walk away. They actually have a, they do certain things that suggest that they ritualize the casting of the member of the clan. So it's, there are all kinds of really interesting things that suggest that there's a lot more to other species than that meets the eye. We as humans don't really have a faculty for understanding what soul there is in other species. I've always felt that there's much more sentience to at least higher life forms than we give them credit for.
So is it sentience that makes an animal worthy of our attention or our respect?
I don't know. It seems to me that the moral issue, sometimes the way we frame it is, should we eat them or not? You know, should we kill them and eat them or not? And it's been striking me lately that that's not really the moral question. You know, you were talking, the words, your words were imprison and torture and kill and eat. And we associate eating animals with the way we eat them now, which is they are imprisoned, tortured, and killed. That's what happens to the animals we eat. But there have been other times and places and other peoples in which killing an animal to eat it wasn't imprisoning and torturing and killing it, but was deeply a part of a community of life in which the purpose of a particular weak deer or weak rabbit was to die at that point to sustain the life of another creature, meaning a human creature. And only the enough was taken to eat, and it was done in respect, and it was done, you know, honoring, you know, sometimes ritually honoring the life of the animal. And it seems to me that that's a very different moral act, even in terms of the ecology of the community, that to take the weak one so that the big species could thrive, and then to take only one, arrows as much as was needed, and to do it in a quick, humane killing for the need of the tribe was very different. Is very different than imprisoning, torturing, and killing, which is the way we eat. So it's just been occurring to me. I was reading about some Aboriginal peoples in Australia, and it struck me that no longer was the moral issue killing. Their killing didn't seem at all immoral to me, but the moral issue is. The way in which the relationship with the animal leads to and includes its death. And it makes all the way in which all the animals we eat, it renders it immoral. I mean the torturing, butchering, and blah, blah, blah. But it just doesn't seem to me anymore that it's the killing and eating that is the question, as I've read how other peoples
throughout history have killed and eaten animals.
Well, even in our culture, if you take a small farm where an animal is pasture raised with other animals and they can graze, or if it's the chicken they can roost and they can scratch, versus the chicken that's in the 2x2 cage with 6 other chickens on 24 hours a day, like, and slaughtered, it's a whole different lifestyle that that animal's given before it's fortunate. And a humane death is very different than bleeding to death or whatever.
Well, that's kind of in the category of the other category of killing.
But a little more accessible in this day and time than a hunter-gatherer society, since we haven't really been interested.
But the issue of sentience, do we care, for example, how if we had snails crammed in cages or whatever for event, for use in as escargot, or do we only care about mammals like chickens, turkeys, cows, things like that? I mean, at what point is there not a serious ethical issue with the way creatures are treated?
What does sentience mean? I've never known the real definition of the word, respect for all sentient beings.
I don't have a proper, careful definition, but the way in which I use it with my students is a being which is in some way self-conscious and also has sort of tactile nerves, that can feel.
I'm sorry. This is an interesting topic. So.
No. This is a discussion. Please talk.
Yeah. That's an excellent question, I think, because, I think we should ask ourselves, just does that matter? Does it matter that something has a soul? Does it matter if it's sentient? Does it matter if it has consciousness? What does that matter? Or does it only matter that it's part of the life cycle and deserves our reverence? Because anything that we do to one part of the life cycle, we do to the entire life cycle.
Right. And when you begin to ask that question, it gets both easier and harder, okay? Because you notice when we made this list of pets, it's easy to think of pets as people and that we should be nice to them and that dogs shouldn't be beaten and that animals should be rescued from the jaws of death of the Humane Society, et cetera, et cetera. And easy to think of our food animals as not people, okay? And yet that's really a rather arbitrary distinction, as we've all discovered. Even those of us who are vegetarians have a hard time not getting rid of a wasp's nest, not fumigating for termites. Mm-hmm. Carpenter ants are deaf to a place like this. And I challenge us to think of whether we've managed to get away without swatting those really awful flies. Okay.
Bacteria.
Oh, certainly. Every time we wash our hands after taking dirty dishes to the dishpit, right?
Over the years, the killing of mice at Holden and how it's to be accomplished. Do you put them in a trap or do you put out bait, which causes them a long, painful death? And this has gone on for years, back and forth.
And anyone who's had field mice knows that if you put a field mouse out, and 5 minutes later it's in your house again, right? You can't just put them out. You need to get rid of them. So it's a more complicated question than whether they're sentient or not, although sentience is necessarily a piece of our concern about animal rights. I can read just a bit of what Carol Adams, who's wonderful on this, and who nearly turned all of my students into vegetarians overnight, says about this. Anybody been to an egg farm, either? Yeah. Describe.
Well, it's just all these chickens kind of squished together and just forced to lay eggs.
Yeah, two or three or four to a tiny wire cage.
It smells really...
In a dark...
Really foul.
Right. In a dark house with tens of thousands of chicken laying hens in one house. And that's their lives. And then you have to go through every so often and just clear out the dead ones. Right?
The ones I've been to have been light because they keep them off lights on 24 hours, or 20 in most of the cases in North Carolina.
They keep the lights on, but it's not natural light. It's
bulbs,
right? And Carol Adams describes the kinds of conditions animals are kept on in. Veal calves are kept in crates that measure 22 inches wide by 54 inches long, where they cannot turn around since exercise would increase muscle development, toughen the flesh, and slow weight gain. Standing on slatted floors causes a constant strain, and diarrhea a frequent problem because of their improper diet, which is meant to keep their flesh pale, causes the slats to become slippery and wet, and the calves often fall, getting leg injuries. When taken to slaughter, many of them can hardly walk. And you can go through almost every species that we eat and describe similar conditions. Usually they're starved for 24 hours before slaughter, so they won't be so messy to clean out, you see. And this is also stressful. Animal husbandry books encourage you not to name the animals you're raising so that you won't feel close to them, so that when you have to kill them, it will be easier, et cetera.